morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, we'll learn more about the completed construction project at the McAlpin Lockson Dam on the Ohio River. First, improving early childhood development and education in Kentucky is the focus of ongoing hearings in Frankfort. Kentucky Public Radio's Tony McVeigh dropped by one of the hearings to see what types of topics are being discussed.
Did you know that hearing begins prior to birth? It's true, says Carolyn Kistler of the Early Hearing Detection and Intervention Program in the Cabinet for Health and Family Services.
The fetus at around 24 weeks can hear outside noises, and so we know that begins that neural connections that we make to hearing later.
But Kistler told the Governor's Task Force on Early Childhood Development and Education, hearing difficulties are the most common sensory birth defect.
In Kentucky, we have 55,000 births a year, which means that somewhere between 1,350 and 2,700 of those babies, if you look at the statistics, then you're going to find that those children are born with hearing loss.
Therefore, she says it's vital for hearing loss to be diagnosed before 3 months of age.
We should know whether or not they have a hearing loss or they do not. And also, with that in mind, that before they're 6 months of age, that intervention services are in place.
A law approved in 2000 established state hearing screening mandates for newborns. And while the measure increased the number of children being screened, it required little follow-up on their progress. That was resolved this year with legislation setting audiological standards, identifying approved assessment centers, and requiring them to report their findings to the state. All of these efforts are improving early childhood health care and development, says Task Force member Sadiqua Reynolds, but more needs to be done. She says parents of newborns need more information on what services are out there.
What is frustrating to me as a very young and new mother, it's interesting that this information, why didn't I have it? It seems that the best thing we could do, if we have very little money, or is it no money at all? Little to no money, but maybe the best bang for our buck would be the training and support for the parents and professionals.
And that's where the task force comes in, says Health and Family Services Secretary Janie Miller, who co-chairs the panel. The group is covering all facets of early childhood development, from hearing and vision to oral health, diseases and immunizations, education, daycare, and even substance abuse treatment programs for pregnant and postpartum women.
We want to identify where we are doing a good job and to make sure that that is integrated and coordinated and communicated so that, in fact, we have pieces of a system, but we want to work toward pulling that system together so that it, in fact, is a full-fledged system of service and support, again, making sure that our young children are developing in the way that they need to do, because again, one stage of life builds upon the prior stage.
And she believes one of the best ways to do that is to build on strong early childhood programs already in place in the Commonwealth, like Kids Now. Developed during the administration of Governor Paul Patton, KIDS stands for Kentucky Invests in Developing Success.
I think the Kids Now program, funded with tobacco settlement funds, was a significant, cohesive program.
But Miller says the state needs to reach even higher, and the task force will continue looking for answers. Governor Beshear's executive order creating the panel set no specific date for a final report, but calls on the group to, quote, develop a unified vision for early childhood education and development. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Tony McVeigh in Frankfort.
Officials with the Army Corps of Engineers Louisville District announced this month they recently finished work on a massive construction project, the McAlpin Lock Replacement. I spoke with the Corps' Carol Labashowski about the project and the movement of commercial traffic along the Ohio River Basin.
When were the original McAlpin Lock and locks installed?
Well, the structure dates back to the 1800s, actually, with the building of the Portland Canal. And then over time, that structure was added to making it two locks. And then in the 60s, of course, we had a renovation where we gained a large 1,200-foot chamber, and then up to the present day where we just have completed another 1,200-foot chamber, bringing the total project to twin lock chambers on the Ohio River, which is fairly unique. We only have one other lock structure on the lower Ohio, the Smithland blocks, that has twin 1,200-foot chambers.
Now, how long did it take to complete this most recent chamber?
The construction actually took approximately 9 years. Basically, it takes several years of studying and funding just to even get the project underway. So it's been a long haul to get it completed, but we're really fortunate to have a great operating project now.
And this, $400 million, something like that?
That's correct, $430 million, which is cost shared 50% by the federal government and 50% by the Waterways Trust Fund.
This is a very busy part of the river.
Yes, approximately 54 million tons go through the McAlpin locks, average annual, and primarily that is coal. Lots of coal is coming through, grains, aggregates, steel, petroleum. We have a total worth approximately $11.6 billion.
I see. Now, this new chamber will allow all these things to go through a lot more efficiently.
Yes, the benefit to commerce is that if you have a 1,200-foot chamber, a complete 15-barge tow can go through at one time, whereas when you have a smaller chamber, that tow has to be broken in half. So basically, a longer chamber can double the capacity at half the time.
You just announced that this second chamber is recently completed. Is there any area of this that's open to the public?
We have a visitor area, which will be open to the public in May. What we've got new there is a actual structure that goes over the new lock, and it will allow visitors to go right onto the river, well, actually over the river, so they can see a tow locking through.
I see. Is there going to be a grand reopening or a ribbon cutting, that sort of thing?
Yes, we have a dedication ceremony. It's a private ceremony that we're having in May, but we plan to have an open house later in the summer for the general public to attend. But again, we're really looking forward to having the public come and enjoy the visitor area and the structure and learn about navigation on the Ohio River as well. So in May, that visitor area should be open.
Any estimate to how long, I'm sure materials and the engineering and that sort of thing have greatly improved over the years, how long this chamber like this will last before you'll have to go back and replace it?
Well, the engineering design life of these lock chambers, it kind of varies over time because they've been built at different points in time.
Right.
Well, right now, 25% of the Ohio River locks are beyond their design life, and in another, 10 years or so, we're expecting 50% to be. But I'd say it will last at least 60, 80, 90 years. I mean, they're built to last, that's for sure. It really depends on the capacity and the trends of river traffic. And we do know that the river traffic, by 2030, we have studies that show 370 million tons of commerce will still be passing through on the Ohio, which is... right now, we have 270 million tons approximately, so we're predicting increases.
And, of course, these will require daily maintenance as well.
Well, the repair station, we have the Louisville Repair Station located on the Ohio River, and they do maintenance and they do repairs, upkeep, and all our locks are scheduled on a routine and receive, the maintenance that they need, the kind of like the nuts and bolts treatment.
Well, Carol, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Oh, you're welcome.
A series of public meetings begins this week in southern Indiana to get input on how to best tackle the problem of illiteracy. Metro United Way is organizing the effort in what it hopes to be a years-long program called Legacy for Literacy. Stephanie Sanders spoke with Associate Director of Community Building Carrie Coakley about the program and the meetings.
If you could just first explain a little bit about what this literacy initiative is, what it's about, and what some of your concerns are.
All right. Well, in early 2008, we found out that the Indiana Association of United Ways was going to be funding a new round of four community grants. This is funded by Lilly Endowment. And our local United Way decided that this was going to be our first chance to do a regional initiative in Clark, Floyd, and Harrison counties. We've had a presence there for many years, and we've done a lot of work separately in each county, but we knew that there were issues that crossed county lines that affected families in all three counties. So we pulled together a partners team of 14 partners, ranging from community volunteers to our local community foundations, to talk about what are similar issues that our three counties are facing. And what we came up with was the need for our residents to be more functionally literate. And by that, we mean that, well, there are many different definitions of functional literacy, but typically it means the ability to read, write, and calculate figures well enough to carry out activities that many people consider necessary to function in society. So such activities include reading newspapers, training manuals in the workplace, understanding highway maps, and balancing checkbooks. Just basic skills that our service providers saw that community members needed, as well as local employers who saw it in their applicant pools.
So it's mostly anecdotal things you're hearing throughout the community that have led you guys to this belief.
Yes.
Okay.
So we think we know some of the issues that are out there. However, we don't have a lot of the local county data that proves exactly what the needs are. So just this past January, we have contracted with the National Center for Family Literacy, who's going to help us in our first year of this effort to roll out the initiative. And one of the main things that they're doing is conducting a baseline assessment that's going to allow us to see where we stand in our region as far as functional literacy, and it's going to allow us to track our progress over time.
How long do you see the project going on?
Right now, we have it projected out for 5 years, but that's just the preliminary thought. We anticipate this lasting much longer than that. And also, right now, we are focusing our efforts on at-risk youth and adults who have been displaced from their job or are underemployed or underskilled, who have the capacity to do more if they had more training. And we're narrowly focused on these groups because we need to set priorities. We need to see where the energy is in our community, where we can really gain some traction. But we see literacy as an issue from early childhood all the way through adulthood. So we imagine this initiative will grow over time as the community starts to take ownership of it and really helps us move it forward.
So how are you guys envisioning, I understand the need for some sort of baseline data, but where do you go from there? Is it, evening classes for adults? Is it, where do you start? It seems like a really huge issue to tackle.
It really is. And I'll tell you the path we've chosen to move forward on this. We have a small team of implementation partners that are helping us make decisions, local CEOs and volunteers who are very involved in the community. And what we've decided to do is we're going to roll out these community conversations that are starting next week in Harrison County, continuing on in Floyd and Clark County the next week. And what we're doing is we're inviting in the schools, the educators, community members, service providers, parents, and just regular residents to come in and tell us what they see the needs are, as well as employers who have a unique perspective on what the needs of our workforce are, because ultimately what we want to do is help the adults in our community have successful transitions in life to meet their own personal goals. And what we're hoping is these community conversations will give us deeper insight into what people see the needs are in our community and get their input on things that they would actually use. We don't want to start programs that no one's interested in participating in, but if the community helps us design what this is going to look like, we think we'll have much better participation and ownership of this. So these community conversations are going to help us set priorities, immediate next steps that we can work on. And what we're going to do this summer is start a regional literacy council. And this literacy council will be charged with making sure that these priorities get action plans and next steps in place so that we can actually start to make a difference for the community members in helping improve their functional literacy. So this literacy council will be the body in charge moving forward.
And who's going to be on the literacy council?
Well, that has not yet been determined. We have some ideas of folks that we think who definitely would like we'd like to have as a part of the literacy council. People like superintendents or school officials, even parents, people who maybe even need these services themselves, service providers. So we're hoping to have a wide variety of people represented in this team, as well as people from all three counties, because we know that in order to help our community, we need to make sure that what we're doing crosses county lines, because there are many people who live in one county, work in another, or move across county lines a few times throughout their life. So we want to make sure that what we're doing is consistent, but also helping meet the needs of each local community, because each one does have their unique needs.
I did an interview several months ago with someone who was in town with the National Center for Family Literacy. He's a very well-known journalist and who had overcome some literacy problems, had made it all the way through high school and couldn't read.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that he brought up, and it's kind of his mission to spread the word about, you know, problems like this, but one of the things that he said that really stuck with me was that, you know, if you get to a certain point in your life, certainly through high school or beyond that, you kind of develop defense mechanisms because you're out in the world and you can't read, but you come up with other ways to get around, and you're embarrassed, and you know, you don't want to see the shock on people's faces when they find out.
Yeah.
And it becomes hard for them to say, you know what, I can't read and I need to be able to do that, so I'm going to go seek out the help that I need to do that. Are you concerned at all that you're not going to get the people who are struggling with this at the community conversations or on the regional board?
Yes, that is a concern for us. We know that it's important to have people who are facing these issues themselves, because they can give us the true insight into what people with these needs are really feeling and sensing and needing. And we do know that we do have a sensitivity to the fact that it can be embarrassing if you're needing these types of skills. But I think the approach we want to look at it as, everybody in our community is creative, resourceful, and whole. And if you have a dream for your family or yourself, we want to try to help you meet that need. We want to help open doors for you to be able to reach your dreams. And whatever those dreams may be, and those dreams may change over time, but we want to be here for you. We don't want there to be any damage to your ego to be a part of it. And we hope people that need these types of support mechanisms will step up and will be a voice, because that will encourage other people to stand up as well.
And I would imagine you guys are partnering with other, other agencies. So maybe job placement, or maybe, things like the Salvation Army or something like that, and maybe have them refer people to you guys once they know that these sorts of things are in place. Once you have decided what those mechanisms are going to be, are you hoping to have partnerships established there?
Oh, we definitely hope to have partnerships established. And one of the main things that we're going to be doing up front with the Literacy Council, or at least what we're anticipating right now before the community conversations, is finding out who all is doing this good work in our community, because as United Way, we know of many people who are doing work with people who need to increase their functional literacy skills, but we don't know everyone. So first of all, we'd like to be able to recognize everyone who's doing this work, so that when we need to make referrals, we know all the places that are possible for us to make referrals. Then we also hope to recognize where gaps exist once we see where all the services are. That way, those people who are, those service agencies who are already providing services might be able to branch out and provide something additional that we never knew we needed before. And that hopefully there will be partnerships established across the three counties as well. I know there are a few agencies who are partnering that way now, but we really hope to encourage cross-community collaborations. That way, if a child moves from one school district to another, their services don't drop. They're still being provided for. So partnerships is definitely going to be a key in this initiative because it's something that United Way can't do alone, and it's also something we can't do without our community involved. So we hope our community sees themselves as partners in this as well.
You can learn more about the meetings at our website, WFPL.org. When we come back, Kristen Espolon reviews the book, Farewell, My Subaru. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, we'll hear about an effort at Actors Theater to produce plays written by area students. First, you can't open a newspaper, flip through a magazine, or watch an advertisement on a bus go by without hearing the phrase, "Go Green," these days. But what does that actually mean? Author Doug Fine has one answer in his new book, Farewell, My Subaru. Kristen Espeland has this review.
At home, perhaps, going green means using recycled paper towels, combining errands to save gasoline, slicing an organic tomato for your BLT. But truly going green? Reducing your carbon footprint to zero, meaning not using gasoline, making sure the products you use, from food to shampoo, haven't traveled via fossil fuels to your home, powering said home with renewable energy, and on, that takes an entirely different commitment. It's a commitment journalist and author Doug Fine made and tells you about in his new book, Farewell, My Subaru, from Random House. He calls it an epic adventure in local living. I'm not sure I'd call it epic, but I would call it a realistic tale of the difficulties and contradictions involved in living in harmony with the planet. Fine buys a fixer-upper ranch in an isolated valley in New Mexico. His plan is to raise his own food, power the ranch with solar panels, and drive a vehicle on used restaurant grease. To do that, he has to give up his beloved Subaru, nicknamed the Love Subi. He's a city slicker, but he's got the kind of discipline that makes you jealous. Hour-long trail runs every day, the determination to try to learn how to do just about everything himself. But of course, nothing goes according to plan, and nothing is as black and white as good for the earth or bad for the earth. Fine picks up a couple of goats he found on Craigslist, hoping to make his own milk and ice cream locally, but he finds the supplies he needs, like a plastic bucket or veterinary syringes, come all the way from China. He installs a water heater, a solar water heater, but finds the setup heats his water up so much he nearly scalds himself each time he showers. He buys chickens for fresh eggs, but coyotes pick them off one by one. And then this animal lover decides he has to buy a shotgun and learn how to shoot them. Trade-offs, unexpected side effects, ironies. These are the hallmarks of Fine's new life. But he takes us along on his journey. We watch his mistakes and nod knowingly. We laugh at his simultaneous longing for consumer culture. Ready roasted chicken from Walmart, anyone? And willingness to leave it behind. It might take a year and a half before the goats produce milk, but the payoff then would be homemade ice cream. It might take a run-in with a rattlesnake, but soon he'll be able to climb up to his water tank and adjust the levels. It might take some stalling out, but he'll manage to get the veggie oil truck started and be able to drive 100 miles. There are lots of How I Went Green or Let's Go Green books on the market today. Doug Fine's Farewell My Subaru caught my interest and kept it because he's humble, practical, and funny. I'm not sure I'm game enough to buy a ranch in New Mexico, pack a shotgun, or climb three stories up a windmill, but I could definitely relate to Fine's earnest, if naive, approach to the project, as in, how hard could it be? Okay, really hard, but if you don't give up, the literal fruits of your labor are just a few seasons away. For Studio 619, I'm Kristen Espeland.
This month, Actors Theater of Louisville wraps up its Humana Festival of New American Plays. Each year, the theater combs through hundreds of scripts to stage one of the American theater's most prominent events that presents new works by some of the country's up-and-coming and established writers. This spring, the theater staff has also read through hundreds of scripts by area middle and high school students to produce this week's New Voices Play Festival. It features 8 plays written during the theater's program that teaches playwriting in area schools. Elizabeth Kramer spoke with Lee Look, who coordinates the program, and budding playwright Annabelle Horton, a senior at Jeffersonville High School.
How did the New Voices Play Festival get started?
The New Voices Play Festival began as kind of an offshoot of our Playwriting in the Schools program, which was the program where we send teaching artists out into the schools and do extended residencies with the ultimate goal of a 10-minute play or a monologue, depending on the age of the student. Once we sort of established this curriculum and established what we do, it became kind of a logical thing as we wanted to have some sort of performance aspect of it, some element of performance. What we didn't want was the goal of the playwriting program to be a winner of a contest. We wanted the two events to be separate because our primary goal is we want students to write. Now, we also happen to have a contest, which is a way to celebrate 8 to 10 of the plays that were created. But we certainly didn't want one to be the reason for the other. It just became an offshoot.
Well, what year did you start this project and how has it changed to be what it is now?
I've been doing the playwriting program for 5 years. There was, I think, someone that did it for one season before me, but we sort of recreated it when I started. And then I want to say my second or third year, we started doing some sort of contest with a festival, and we began with sort of a reader's theater format. And reader's theater is just people sitting around with scripts, reading the plays to an audience with music stands. Then we did more of a developed reader's theater format with some blocking and people holding scripts. And then we had them take the scripts out of their hands the next year. And this year, it's the most fully realized complete production process that we have. Each play has a stage manager and a dramaturg and a director. The Apprentice Acting Company works with it. They have technical designers.
And how do the high school playwrights participate in that process?
What they do is once their plays are chosen, this year we brought them in for a meeting with the education staff, which is our director, Stephen Ray, and Jacob Stobel, and Jeffrey Moser, and Julie Mercurio, and some of the lit staff. And we talked about their plays. We talked about the process. And from that point, each director and dramaturg started meeting with the playwrights and started editing their plays and working with them to finish them. If they needed finishing, then they were cast. And through the rehearsal process, each playwright was involved to a greater or lesser degree, depending on the relationship that they had with the director.
And Annabelle, your play is called Imagination. Can you tell me a little about your play and how it has evolved through the process?
My play's about a little boy who, he's 10, and he gets left home by himself while his mom goes out to go get dinner. And he just entertains himself using his imagination. And it's just the different scenarios that he imagines. And I wrote it for the school project for an A, and then I found out that I won. So everything has been so much bigger than I thought that it was going to be. We've only had to do like 2 drafts, and it hasn't really been all that much different, which is really cool. And basically they asked me, like, is this what you thought? How does this character relate with this character and stuff?
What are the suggestions that have been made, and what have you learned, and what has it been like to see these words on a page become real on a stage?
It's so cool to just see it, because I had no idea that I was even good enough, close enough to even be considered. So the changes were really minor changes. There weren't any major changes going on, but seeing them being performed was just like each time I get to see it, it gets like even cooler and even cooler and even cooler. So it's just, it's indescribable just how awesome it is to see it.
And what have you realized this year that are milestones in the program? And what do you hope to do going forward?
I think the most significant milestone this year is we've realized through our department, we had a lot of changeover in our department this year, that I'm the only returning person. Everybody else is new in the education department. And what has been realized and implemented is the drawing of the incredible wealth of resources that Actors Theater has to offer at every level. The lit department, the tech department, the directors, the actors, everything has compiled to make this project what it is. It is bigger than us now, than our education department, our little education department in the corner of the office.
And how many students and how many teachers are participating this year?
There's 8 playwrights, so in the contest, but we did, I think, 30 residencies this year. So that would be 27 teachers probably and 25 to 30 students a class. But it's a big year for us. We've expanded a lot and we're working real hard at being in schools that maybe need us more than they can afford us. That's my goal as the director of the playwriting program, is getting us into places where we can be the most helpful.
And why is it important for Actors Theater to be present in the schools here?
I think it depends on what level of Actors Theater you ask that question to. When you ask me that question, I think it's important because learning to write is vital. It's a vital skill. Every time I finish a residency, I tell students I don't care if they ever write another play again, but I feel now if someone handed them a job application, they could write a coherent sentence describing why they want that job. So that, to me, is my answer. If you ask Mark Masterson, what's important? We're fostering a new audience. People that have never heard of a play before or seen a play before or been involved in a play before now have experience that many of our patrons don't have. So it depends on what level of the theater you're asking that question. Both are completely valid answers, I think, but that's why we want to be in the schools.
There's been a lot of talk about what arts education does for the development of young people. And I was just wondering what you have seen through this and where you think that takes place in this program.
Every arts organization that goes into the school system believes that what they do helps young people, and it very well might. However, in order for programs to be validated and to be funded, there has to be data. And that's why arts education tends to get short shrift, because you can prove that math serves you in this way because there's numbers. So my goal in the research that I've been doing, I have a PhD in counseling psychology and I've been taught as a researcher. So my goal has been to try to discover how and if arts education, specifically what we do, playwriting, affects things like literacy, affects things like resiliency, self-concept, self-esteem. And the numbers that we have from that backs up our hypothesis that yes, indeed, learning to write in the way that we teach it does indeed increase a student's ability to be resilient and to have a higher self-concept. That's the goal, I think, of being in the schools, is not only are we teaching them to write, which is great, but what else is that writing teaching them to do? Is it teaching them to be more capable adults? Is it going to help them handle the challenges that life is going to give them? Because many of the students that we come across have challenges that I could never have imagined when I was their age, nor do I want to imagine them. So anything we can give them is one more tool in their toolbox.
And Annabelle, what kind of tools do you feel that this process has given you?
Definitely help with the self-esteem and self-concept for me, because I know I can write a good essay and, good short story sometimes, but just getting in and learning how to do everything definitely helped with every aspect of not only writing, but I'm also in theater, so learning how to write the script helps me understand reading the script and interpreting the script and plays and seeing plays and being able to analyze plays, and it's helped more than I could have even imagined.
Well, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
When we come back, we'll get details about the spring meet at Churchill Downs. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Coming up, we'll hear from a couple of local writers about the writing community in Louisville. First, Churchill Downs' spring meet starts next Saturday, and there have been several changes to the track since the last set of races. New safety measures are in place, night races are planned on several evenings, and coolers will once again be allowed in the infield. Gabe Buller talked with the track's Senior Director of Communications, Darren Rogers, about the changes and how they might help Churchill Downs avoid the financial troubles faced by some other Kentucky racetracks, such as Ellis Park.
What kind of safety preparations have been made?
Well, we've made a number of safety preparations in the last year here at Churchill Downs. In fact, we became the first North American racetrack to be accredited by the NTRA Safety and Integrity Alliance earlier this month. We have instituted a number of groundbreaking policies that we view are in a leadership position here at Churchill Downs. We're the first racetrack in the country to have hired independent, standardized, third-party testing and monitoring of our racetrack and track surfaces. We've also instituted, new for the spring meet, will be super testing of all winning horses for more than 100 performance-enhancing drugs. We also have some new age restrictions that require thoroughbreds to be at least 24 calendar months of age before they are eligible to race. Typically, horses celebrate their birthday on January the 1st, all horses. And now we're going to make sure that they have to be 24 calendar months at the age of two before they can run. Those are some of the highlights of our new safety and welfare initiatives here at Churchill.
Is that Alliance that did the accreditation? Are they a new body?
Yeah, the NTRA Safety and Integrity Alliance was created by the National Thoroughbred Racing Association this past year. And they are putting some measures in place, some rules and guidelines racetracks must adhere to in order to be accredited. And Churchill Downs is proud to be the first racetrack in the country to receive accreditation. Churchill's racing surface has a very strong reputation throughout the years. Track Superintendent Butch Lear, with more than 40 years of experience, has done a fabulous job, and that NTRA Safety and Integrity Alliance confirmed it.
How does that compare to the safety standards in for racetracks in other countries?
Well, that's a little difficult to – it's difficult for me to speak for other racetracks. I can tell you that Churchill Downs – is a leader and the only racetrack in the country right now that has independent standardized third-party testing and monitoring of its track surface. We've hired Dr. Mick Peterson from one of the foremost authorities on track surface and racing testing. He actually has a biomechanical hoof apparatus that he attaches to the back of a truck, and he'll drive around the racetrack with that apparatus at the speed of a horse, which is in the neighborhood of 30 to 40 miles per hour. And that apparatus will measure how far down it goes in the racetrack, the consistency of the surface, is there any slippage, etc. We're the only racetrack in the country, along with our sister racetracks here at Churchill Downs Incorporated, that would be Calder Racecourse, Arlington Park, and also fairgrounds in New Orleans that have that. Same goes for the super testing of all winning horses. Every horse in every race here at Churchill Downs in the past, actually I should correct that, every horse that wins a race at Churchill Downs and a random horse in each race has historically been tested for some prohibited medications. Usually it's about 50. Churchill Downs is implementing super testing, which has been prevalent in graded stakes races in years past, but we're going to implement it on each and every race. So the winner of every race here at Churchill Downs and one random horse in each race will be tested for more than 100 illegal performance-enhancing drugs. And that's part of the integrity, and that's also part of the safety.
Are a lot of the safety measures being taken, were they realized after Eight Bells last year, after Eight Bells fell?
We've had a number of safety measures in place throughout the years here at Churchill Downs. We actually had been working on the safety and welfare initiative prior to last year's Kentucky Derby. Obviously, with what happened with Eight Bells, accelerated that process and made it much more important that we get out in front of the issue. We're communicating a number of the issues and procedures that we've had in place over the years. I mean, there aren't many people that realize that a state veterinarian pre-examines every horse in every race prior to them running to make sure that they almost pass a physical, so to speak. Those are the types of things that we're getting out in front of, and we have a new safety center right outside our main high-traffic Gate 17 entrance that will explain to fans and onlookers a number of those measures that we've already had in place and the new ones that we have to make our track even safer.
Making a career as a rider is a path that involves plenty of solitary time. But two riders who grew up in Louisville say that path has been a bit easier through the community of riders they found in the Kentucky Center's Governor School for the Arts and a group called the Afrolatchin Poets. This week, poet Mitchell Douglas and author Tanya James will speak at the Kentucky Center about their writing lives. Mitchell is the author of Cooling Board, a long-playing poem about soul musician Donny Hathaway. Hathaway often worked with Roberta Flack and on the song Where Is the Love. He died in 1979 after suffering from depression and schizophrenia. Tanya James' first novel, Atlas of Unknowns, hits bookshelves this week and has already received glowing reviews. Mitchell has taught at the Governor's School, and James attended the three-week summer program when she was a high school student. Elizabeth Kramer spoke to Douglas and James about the role that program and their connection with the Afrolatchin Poets have played in their careers.
You've both been involved with Kentucky's Governor's School for the Arts. How did each of you get involved initially?
Actually, I got involved as a member of the creative writing faculty in about 2004, and I was looking for, I guess, a unique teaching experience. I like to work with young writers. Having come up through the Black Achievers Program in Louisville as a teen, I knew the importance of mentorship, having somebody to be able to connect with. So I wanted to make that kind of impact. And it's just really been the best experience for me because I think you learn just as much as you teach.
And Tanya?
Well, I came to GSA as a student when I was 16. When I was applying, I just thought it would be something for my college resume, which is pretty much how I approached everything. But And I approached writing sort of like mathematics, you know, like there's a right way and a wrong way. And I'd been sort of writing poems that were, you know, closely modeled on poems that I read in school, so Browning or Shakespeare or even Poe. And I'd be writing about, like, loss and love and ghosts and things I'd really never experienced. So I kind of came to GSA with intentions that were kind of more, you know, a means to an end. But I found something very different when I got there.
How did that kind of mentorship, that kind of program, even with you, Mitchell, because it was a different program, but it still had that mentorship aspect to it, how did that contribute to your development as an artist and a writer?
I have to say the Afrolatchin Poets have contributed to my development as well. I'm a big advocate for this kind of communal learning experience where people kind of enter into this agreement together that they will help each other and kind of help you take that next step. And I think writing is all about that. You need someone that has the insight on what does it mean to write a good poem and how can you get there. And the Afrolatchin Poets, for me, well, a lot of it was leading by example, you know, reading other members' work and thinking about, oh, I don't have this kind of imagery in my own work and this is what I want to aspire to. I'm not sure if I would still be writing if I didn't have the group, you know, and we're approaching 20 years together, which is kind of crazy to even think about that, but it's a reason why I'm still here.
And Tanya?
Thinking back to 16 and 17, my teachers were Frank X. Walker and Kelly Ellis, and their mentorship meant everything to me. I think, as I said, I just had a certain idea of who writers were, what they looked like, what you're supposed to be writing about. It just didn't seem to me that the province of my subject matter deserved poetry or deserved voice. And I think at GSA, our teachers are continually trying to tease out our own voices, and they recognize something in each of us, and they encouraged it. And the class was so personal in a way that nothing was before. And, you know, to be taken seriously at that age is such a unique experience. And, you know, those mentors, I feel, continue to give me support. And I'm also a member of Afrolatchin Poets. They introduced me to a whole set of writers, such a diverse set of writers, and that's really informed my writing life today.
One of the things I think is interesting, too, about both of you growing up partially here, I was thinking being an Asian American growing up in Louisville, it's a small community. And then also, I know with you, Mitchell, that being in Iowa, it was a small African American community. And how did writing play, I guess, in trying to find your voice in a place where there didn't seem, I guess, on the outside to be lots of people like you?
You know, writing saved me. I always say writing and music because I left Louisville and moved to Iowa City, and I was kind of like, you know, I don't know if I can take this. But then I connected with other people, made really good friends through music, and then started writing poetry when I was about 13. It was kind of like, you know, I found my place. I found my footing. It was like, this is right. And, you know, I think we all starting at such a young age, kind of falling in and falling out of a relationship with writing. I still look back to that time of being 13 and saying that this is my voice and being able to put that down on paper. It was a really empowering moment, I think, for me.
Yeah, and I think being an outsider, to me, I mean, I didn't feel like an outsider purely because of ethnicity. I mean, I felt like an outsider for a lot of reasons that a lot of teenage kids do. But I think it's an interesting vantage to have as a writer. It makes you kind of look at your world a little differently and maybe even makes you turn inward. But I think writing saved me. I think reading also saved me. I just tended to look towards actually African-American writers when I was growing up because just that experience, something about that appealed to me. So I was sort of as obsessed with Toni Morrison and Alice Walker. Those were people I sort of looked to back then and still now.
Can you talk a little bit about how finding your voice and your story in your latest work harkens back to what you learned growing up?
I like so many different kinds of music. It kind of made sense for my first collection to be about a musical hero. And so I just really wanted to kind of pay homage to Donny Hathaway because there's not a lot of information out there about him. And to write poetry and write in a musical and rhythmic way just kind of made sense. And I looked at, you know, my place in all of this and thinking, well, I'm going to write in persona. I'm going to present this as his voice, you know, and who are my models? In the African-American tradition, I looked largely at Langston Hughes, his montage of A Dream Deferred. It was a huge inspiration to me in teaching me how to write in persona and to kind of make my own way. That was what was key for me. So it was a lot of experimentation, but that was the fun part, to try different voices out, to think about what Donny was like when he was here or what Roberta Flack was like, the encouragement of his mother and grandmother in trying to bring those people to the page. So I think this was a fun experience for me and just to kind of testing my limits as a writer.
Tanya, what about you with Atlas of Unknowns?
Before the novel, I'd always written stories, and I tend to like to play around with very different voices. And this was the first time I was sort of working in a much broader canvas. And the voice, I think, is really important to me, trying to figure that out. You know, in the first 50 pages, I think I was just kept rewriting it and rewriting it and trying to find the right tone, the right voice that would accommodate for humor as well as tragedy. And I think the voice also had to sort of, I was searching for a kind of compassion for the characters I was writing about. I mean, I was reading around a lot. I think that reading provides me with inspiration all the time. So I'm constantly reading while I'm writing, and I'm sure the voices of certain contemporary writers also kind of filtered in somehow, influenced me in some way.
When it comes to speaking about your writing for the Governor's School for the Arts, when you got the invitation to speak for this panel, what were your initial reactions?
I'm glad that I can help and be a part of a Kentucky Writers' Day celebration, but also something that's going to help Governor's School in terms of raising people's awareness about the program and having them get involved. I'm honored. I guess this has just been a really rewarding experience for me. I mean, I tell the parents every year at GSA, it's like I enjoy meeting your babies every year and watching them grow because I think we get as much out of it or even more out of it. And sometimes it's just the relationship between the writer and student is really great. And so for me to be a part of this and to, you know, bring attention to GSA, you know, is important. It's an honor.
GSA was possibly the kind of biggest turning point for me. You know, I haven't lived in Kentucky for many years. I've been living in New York. But, you know, I still refer to Kentucky as home.
Well, thanks so much for being with us.
You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at WFPL.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.